Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Campaign controversy. The president denies allegations he referred to fallen U.S. troops as losers as Joe Biden escalates his criticism of the administration. Then, ongoing outrage. Protests continue in Rochester as the suspect in last weekend's fatal shooting of a protester in Portland is killed in a confrontation with police. Plus, healthcare and the pandemic. We compare the impact of COVID-19 on the American medical system to other systems around the world.
Leadership has been pretty central across the world. When I look at countries across the world, how seriously leaders have taken the virus, how effectively they've mobilized forces has had a very dramatic effect.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down the presidential candidates' responses to social unrest and government's push for a coronavirus vaccine. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The U.S. economy is clawing its way back from its losses at the height of the pandemic. Employers added 1.4 million jobs in August. It was less than previous months, but even so, the nation's unemployment rate dropped almost 2 full percentage points to 8.4%. We'll have more on the economy later in the program. But first, William Brangham reports on the fallout intensifying today over an article that alleges President Trump made disparaging remarks about U.S. troops.
It's a fake story, and it's a disgrace that they're allowed to do it.
President Trump is firing back after a report in The Atlantic magazine, and later confirmed by multiple news organizations, said the president several times called fallen American service members losers and suckers. In the Oval Office today, the president again flatly denied ever making the comments and instead touted military spending under his administration.
There's nobody that considers the military, and especially people that have given their lives in the military, to me, they're heroes.
Who the heck does he think he is?
His Democratic opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, whose own son, Beau, served in Iraq, called the reported comments deplorable.
When my son volunteered and joined the United States military as the Attorney General and went to Iraq for a year, won the Bronze Star and other commendations, he wasn't a sucker.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was on a 2018 trip to Paris when the president allegedly made some of these comments, told Fox News he doesn't remember them.
I've never heard the president use the language that assertedly is said in that article.
But going back to his 2016 campaign, Mr. Trump has had a complicated relationship with the military.
Amazing people. These are amazing people.
He's often praised those with military experience and has had many working with him in the White House.
I don't like losers.
But other times, he's questioned their service, like his widely criticized comments about Senator John McCain, who was tortured and imprisoned for more than 5 years during the Vietnam War.
He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured.
President Trump overwhelmingly won among veterans in 2016, but since then, his approval rating among members of the military has dropped to 38% in a new poll from Military Times. With 2 months until Election Day, Mr. Biden has a 4-point advantage with these voters. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
There continue to be protests and outrage in the U.S. over police response and how demonstrators are responding to each other, including a pair of deadly incidents. Amna Nawaz has an update on what's happening in Rochester, New York, and Portland, Oregon.
New Yorkers today awoke to more details, but still many questions, months after the death of another black man, Daniel Prude, after an encounter with Rochester police. The renewed focus follows more protests after video emerged Wednesday showing Prude in police custody in March. Police handcuffed Prude after he ran naked into the street. Officers say he was spitting and put a hood on his head as part of a new statewide COVID-19 safety rule. They then pressed his face into the pavement for 2 minutes. Prude died a week later. The county medical examiner ruled his death a homicide caused by asphyxiation and listed acute intoxication from the drug PCP as a contributing factor. His family says Prude had struggled with mental health issues.
First and foremost,
the head of the Rochester Police Union said today the video misrepresented what happened and that officers followed protocol by using the so-called spit hood during the pandemic.
An officer does not have the ability to go or disregard what they're mandated to do and what they're trained to do.
Prude's family is calling for the officers to be fired and charged.
That was a full-fledged lynching. I don't care what nobody say.
On Thursday, the mayor suspended seven officers involved with pay and apologized to the family.
Mr. Daniel Prude was failed by our police department, our mental health care system, our society, and he was failed by me.
Meanwhile, across the country, in Portland, Oregon, protests took a deadly turn. After the Saturday shooting of a man associated with a right-wing group, the shooting suspect, who self-identified as a left-wing anti-fascist, last night was himself shot and killed by law enforcement, who'd tracked him to neighboring Washington State. Protests in Portland are expected to continue this weekend as the nation marks 100 days since the death of George Floyd. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
In the day's other news, authorities in Cleveland, Ohio, are investigating the fatal shooting of a police detective who had just joined the FBI's Violent Crime Task Force. He was killed last night in his car along with an informant during an undercover drug operation. Officials arrested three people and are looking for more suspects. The U.S. has now recorded more than 187,000 COVID-19 deaths. That comes amid fears of a rise in new cases going into the Labor Day weekend. In Geneva, the World Health Organization warned that vaccines may not be widely available until mid-2021. The agency warned that it would not recommend any until proven safe and stressed their distribution must be a global effort.
The first priority must be to vaccinate some people in all countries rather than all people in some countries. Using vaccines as a global public good is in the national interest of each and every country.
Also today, scientists in Russia belatedly published results from early trials of their COVID vaccine. Its developers said it appeared to be safe and triggered a sufficient immune response. The government approved it last month without undergoing large-scale trials. The Department of Homeland Security has warned Russia that it is working to undermine the American public's trust in voting by mail. A new intelligence bulletin said that the Kremlin is spreading false claims that mail-in ballots are vulnerable to fraud and manipulation. Many of those unfounded claims have been echoed by President Trump and his Attorney General, William Barr. In Massachusetts, former Marine Jake Auchincloss won the primary to be the Democratic nominee to fill the seat of U.S. Congressman Joe Kennedy III. Results from Tuesday's election were delayed after cities were inundated by nearly a million mail-in ballots. Kennedy decided not to seek re-election so that he could challenge incumbent Senator Ed Markey. But Kennedy lost that race on Tuesday. Crews in Beirut spent the day searching for a possible trapped survivor 1 month after the devastating blast. Rescue workers painstakingly removed debris after a search dog flagged a possible body, and rescue teams detected a pulsing signal from beneath a destroyed building. The massive explosion killed some 190 people and injured 6,000 others. And on Wall Street today, stocks added to their losses on the heels of yesterday's sell-off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 159 points to close at 28,133. The Nasdaq lost 145 points, and the S&P 500 shed 28. Still to come on the NewsHour, Americans continue to feel the financial stresses of COVID as the economy struggles to recover. Hong Kong adjusts to life under a draconian national security law imposed by the Chinese government. We compare the impact of COVID-19 on the American medical system to other systems around the world and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The U.S. economy is continuing to climb back from the worst depths of the pandemic. Today's unemployment report did contain good news about more workers returning to the labor force, but hiring in August slowed compared to the previous few months. The U.S. economy has now recovered about half of the 22 million jobs shed during the plunge. Before we look at the latest, let's hear from a few Americans about the huge struggles they're facing.
My name is Umut Bayramoğlu. I live in Lawrence, Kansas.
My name is Michael Dorsey. I'm in San Diego, California.
My name is Sean Manny. I'm from Martin, Tennessee.
My weekly unemployment benefits is $317 a week. My rent is $290 a week. Doesn't take much math, man. $317 minus $290. That's $27 a week. So that's it.
This is the first time in my life that I've applied for any sort of assistance at all. I started going to the food bank in March, and that was a difficult adjustment to make. It was a food bank that I actually previously had volunteered for.
I was pursuing my PhD, and I was in the last year of that. We didn't qualify for unemployment insurance. So I had to, unfortunately, make the call last week to sell my house. And I guess I was fortunate enough that it happened pretty quickly, but it was my house, and I had to give that up in order to, so that I could have health insurance, so that, you know, that I could pay my bills. I'm in debt, maxed out my credit cards, and not really a lot of options.
We are one people, one country. So if one of us hurting, is just like in your family. If your brother's hurting, you're hurting, and you help your brother out.
And we thank each one of you for sending in what is going on in your life. Millions of Americans, we know, are enduring exactly the sort of profound economic hardship we just heard about. Given that, what do today's job numbers tell us? Diane Swonk is the chief economist with Grant Thornton. She's back with us to help with some answers. Diane, welcome back to the NewsHour. So 1.4 million jobs added last month. What does that tell us?
Well, the good news is that we generated over a million jobs in the private sector. About 240,000 of those job gains were temporary census hires that will go away at the end of September. So we still had over a million job gains in the private sector. The problem is that's not nearly enough or fast enough to get us out of this deep hole we're still in, which is more than 11 million from the peak we saw in February. That's a huge number compared to the 8.8 million jobs we lost during the Great Recession. And so we really are still sort of chasing a moving target here. And the pace of job growth is slowing, and our ability to pull workers back in from the sidelines is starting to diminish. In fact, we've lost 3.7 million workers in the labor force since that peak in February. So if you included those as the unemployed, you would have an unemployment rate closer to 10% or higher than what we have today, the official rate of 8.4%. Also, the ranks of the permanently unemployed are rising right now, and that's something that we don't want to see happening right now. The people that are on long-term unemployment and that have figured out they're not going to be recalled to their jobs in a still socially distant world is rising.
And as we said, fewer jobs added in August than had been added in June and July. Which sectors, Diane Swonk, are doing well, are robust, and which ones are struggling?
Well, there's really no robust sectors out there. The finance sector has lost the fewest number of jobs, but every major sector has lost jobs since February, and that's important to remember as we look at this data. Of course, the leisure and hospitality sector lost the most jobs and has regained the most jobs, but there's still 4 million down from their peak in February. And that really gives you a sense of, even as we've reopened, how much it is a struggle for restaurant and bars to be able to fully restaff when you still need to socially distance. The same is true of hotels. So I think that's really what the moral of the story is. Those hardest hit, those low-wage jobs hardest hit, are the hardest to bring back. And of course, there's still many workers that are working from home, or they're at home and being paid but not working. Those workers, 11.4% of the unemployed, those workers are important because they're the most vulnerable for additional layoffs as we go into the fall. And that includes high-wage workers as well. So even though low-wage workers continue to get hit the hardest, and women have sort of not even come back into the labor force, we got a nice uptick in labor force participation, but it wasn't by women because, of course, their kids are still online and at home, and that makes it harder for them to rejoin the labor force. That's really compromising many households' ability to pay for food and rent, as you noted in your earlier segment, by all those voices of people that are still struggling.
So quickly, Diane Swonk, the reason that jobs aren't coming back faster than they are, it all goes back to COVID?
The course of COVID will determine the course of the economy. As viruses surge again on the heels of colleges and schools reopening, you see again people pull back, and we've really seen a plateau in job growth, a slowdown in the pace of job growth, and a plateau in spending at the places we need to see job growth most, restaurant, bars, and hotels. So that really is hard going into what will be a colder season and an inability to also have outside service at many of these establishments.
So tough hearing this and hearing these stories of real Americans. Diane Swonk, thank you so much. Good to see you.
You too.
A letter released by UN human rights officials today blasted a new national security law in Hong Kong imposed 2 months ago by China. And with its now customary fire, Beijing shot back, telling the UN to, quote, stop meddling. Special correspondent Divya Gopalan tells us now what has changed in Hong Kong and what has not.
This is one of the few places where evidence of months of anti-government protests last year is still displayed openly. The Yao Lei Fong restaurant is known for its traditional roast meats and a timeline of the 2019 protest movement. But look a little closer and you'll find black tape covering the slogans that became the anthems for the protests. Restaurant owner Jerry Chong says they've obscured anything which could be defined as subversive after China's Communist Party imposed a wide-ranging national security law on July the 1st.
Not a single person could tell us or define what was against the law. What can you say? What can't you say? It's really hard to say how I feel, but there's fear in everyone's hearts.
Beijing says the law is necessary to bring stability after months of sometimes violent anti-government protests last year. It targets crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign powers. One of the leaders of the democracy movement here, activist Joshua Wong, says he is in the crosshairs of the law. He disbanded his pro-democracy political party hours before it came into effect.
My life is in risk. And I'm not sure will the Hong Kong police knock on my door 5 a.m. in the morning, storm into my house and arrest me suddenly.
Also raising fear, the newly set up Beijing-controlled security agency, which operates outside the city's legal system. Officers can investigate and extradite suspects to the communist-controlled courts of mainland China.
There is a particular clause which in very rare circumstances will enable a case which occurs here to be transferred to the mainland for trial.
Grenville Cross was Hong Kong's longest-serving chief prosecutor and is now an honorary professor at two of the city's top universities.
Now, as I understand it, that will only happen extremely rarely and in very clearly defined circumstances, circumstances where Hong Kong itself is not able to handle the case.
The law marks Beijing's full takeover of Hong Kong, which was promised 50 years of relative autonomy after the British handover in 1997. In response, the Trump administration removed the special trade and economic privileges granted to Hong Kong, saying it's now just like any other part of China.
We have our independent legal systems.
We have our independent currency. We are using common law as our legal system, the rule of law. It's still very different from China.
Pro-Beijing Legislative Counselor Felix Chung, who represents the textile and garment industry, says the United States is complicit in stripping away the city's highly regarded international status.
I don't think Hong Kong is changed by that law. Hong Kong is changed by the international conflict, especially between US and China.
But according to the American Chamber of Commerce, the national security law is affecting the business environment. 40% of US companies surveyed had plans to move capital, assets, or operations out of the city. Police can raid premises without a court warrant, and they can order internet firms to remove content or seize their equipment. Online media giants like Facebook and Google say they've stopped responding directly to data requests from the Hong Kong police. A number of activists, students, and protesters have already been arrested for social media posts. And with no clear wording of what is exactly illegal, any activity, secessionist, demanding independence, saying Hong Kong is not China, could be prosecutable. At stake is the city's freedom of speech and vibrant media industry, which doesn't exist anywhere else in China.
According to the Hong Kong government, the national security law targets only a small minority of lawbreakers. But it has triggered widespread unease. We've certainly felt it while putting together this report with a number of previously outspoken figures on both sides of the political divide refusing our interview requests due to concerns that what they say could potentially be used against them. Although it is here in the local press where the most chilling effect of the new law can be felt.
The Apple Daily is the city's most read pro-democracy newspaper. On August 11, 200 police stormed the newsroom in a raid that was live-streamed to a shocked city. They arrested top executives, including the paper's billionaire owner, Jimmy Lai, who has strong ties in Washington. He faces charges of colluding with foreign countries, a charge he's told the NewsHour late last month that's open to interpretation.
They are very strict about collusion with a foreign power. Even now, accepting your interview could be collusion with foreign power. So I have to be cautious of what I say. You know, so this is the fact of life here now.
The political landscape is also rapidly changing after a dozen Democratic candidates who do not support the law were disqualified from legislative council elections. Then, in an unprecedented move, the September vote was postponed for a year. Authorities say due to the pandemic, but the opposition says it's to wipe out Democratic support. Art, culture, and academics are also under pressure to become more Beijing-friendly. Public libraries have pulled books by democracy advocates, while many publishers and bookstores have started self-censoring. Bookshop owner Daniel Lee says there's still demand for books about the protests, and he'll keep them on the shelves as long as he can.
The greatest worry is surely that they come in one day and tell me that those books, even there has not been a book list, are banned from being sold, and I've already breached the law.
On the streets of Hong Kong, there are still pockets of defiance, even as it's adapting to the law. Lenin walls, named after the singer for their messages of solidarity and democracy, were a distinct feature of the protests, which disappeared when the law came into effect. They are now sprouting again in many places across the city, this time as a blank mosaic.
I would say that national security law tried to kill Hong Kong, but it can't kill Hong Kong people. With the spirit of Hong Kongers, we will continue to resist and fight back.
A message that while Beijing can force the city in line with the rest of the country almost overnight, it will take a lot more than a law to change the people of the city. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Divya Gopalan in Hong Kong.
We turn now to our series on universal health care in three different nations and concerns in our own country. William Brangham filmed this series before the pandemic exploded. Tonight, he looks at how those countries have responded to COVID since then and what lessons they may provide.
We started this series in Houston, Texas, looking at the U.S. healthcare system. And then we visited the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and Australia, asking how is it they've managed to do what we haven't, achieve universal healthcare. But one thing we didn't address is how those nations dealt with this novel coronavirus. Does a universal health system give inherent advantages when a pandemic occurs? To answer that, I spoke again recently with our collaborator on this series, Dr. Ashish Jha. He's the newly appointed dean of Brown University's School of Public Health. Ashish, very, very good to see you again. I wonder, could you start off by just giving us a quick synopsis of how these three countries, Australia, Switzerland, and the UK, how did they handle the pandemic?
Yeah, so William, the bottom line is I think all three of those countries have done a much better job than we have. There's a lot of variation. They're not all the same. UK probably has handled it the worst of the three. They had quite a bad outbreak in the beginning, and a lot of people got sick and a lot of people died. But they're in much better shape now than we are. And the other two countries, both Switzerland and Australia, I think have really been exemplars of how you handle this pandemic. We saw in Switzerland not just really good messaging that led to a pretty substantial lockdown, but then also government engagement in buying and protective equipment that help protect doctors and nurses. Australia, I think, has been terrific at building up their testing infrastructure. They are testing widely with very, very low percentage of positive tests. So the strategies look different in each country, but each of them did different things really well.
And how much of the actual structure of their healthcare systems contributed to that response?
So I would say a little. There's no doubt about it that there are features of their healthcare system that gave them certain advantages over us and over ours. But overall, the big difference is really about the public health response, which has been very different in each of those three countries compared to the U.S.
You touched on this, but how much does a nation's political leadership rely on how well they respond? I'm thinking in particular of people who've talked about the fact that the UK has Boris Johnson and his cabinet was as influential in the UK's response as compared to having their national health system.
I would say leadership's been pretty central across the world. When I look at countries across the world, how seriously leaders have taken the virus, how effectively they've mobilized forces has had a very dramatic effect. And so even Boris Johnson, who I think initially did not take the virus as seriously, really struggled with what the UK's response should be, eventually got on board with a much more science-driven process. Of course, he himself ended up getting infected and quite sick, and I suspect that probably helped shape some of his thinking about the seriousness of this virus. But certainly both in Switzerland and Australia, we saw very different types of leadership, much more engagement, much less misinformation coming from political leaders.
When you look at the U.S. response, are there aspects of our healthcare system and the way we structure healthcare in America that impacted our ability to respond?
There are. I mean, there are obviously a lot of strengths of our healthcare system, fabulous doctors and nurses, really good hospitals. But some of the payment issues, I think, have really hindered us. There are examples like in nursing homes, when we wanted to start testing healthcare workers, we couldn't figure out who was going to pay for it. The bigger issue in my mind has been, even though the policy response has been, we will pay for COVID care, the truth is Americans, especially with high deductible health plans or people who don't have insurance, are deeply worried about costs, and rightly so. And that has really prevented them from seeking care. And that kind of fear in the middle of a pandemic really makes it hard for people to do what is necessary. And so I think as we emerge from this pandemic, we're going to really have to look at our payment system and ask, do we really want people to act like consumers in the middle of a pandemic? Do we really need people to feel that extra set of stress? Or can we find a better way?
At the risk of sounding a little too general, is there something about the way those three nations have responded to the pandemic that you think we could learn if, God forbid, we have to go through this again?
Yeah, absolutely. So those three countries have all done it a little differently, right? There's a lot of variation among them. But when you look at the consistent themes, there are two or three things that I think really stand out. One is consistent public health messaging. You did not hear their leaders undermine scientific guidance. I think that's been really critical. Second is all of them have had much more substantial investments in public health. The UK has built up this fabulous testing and tracing infrastructure. They don't think it's as fabulous as it could be, and maybe it's not, but it's certainly much better than ours. What you saw with Switzerland was this incredible investment in making sure that healthcare workers were protected through PPEs. Again, the government getting much more engaged. So it strikes me that messaging is really important, investing in the things that are outside of the healthcare system is important, and then a central role for government to coordinate all of this, because this is not something the private sector can figure out on its own. This is not something a fragmented system can figure out on its own. It's a pandemic. It requires that kind of concerted response.
Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown School of Public Health, as always, thank you so much for your time and thank you for all your help on this series.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for including me and for being part of this.
And now it's time for the political analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Washington Post columnist Jonathan Capehart. Mark Shields is away. So hello to both of you on this Friday night. I want to start with something both candidates did. They went to a city, David, that is where people are truly in anguish over the shooting of a black man. His name is Jacob Blake. It's Kenosha, Wisconsin. We saw both of them go make statements. What did you make, David, of their different approaches?
Well, they were both very true to their core vision, what they've been running on, especially this year, but maybe since the beginning of their political careers. Donald Trump has been running on a sense of menace, a sense that there's a lot of danger out there in the world and that he's the one to restore order. And so the keystone of his visit was the image of him standing behind in front of burned out buildings. And he wants to convey that message. Joe Biden has run as a uniter. And so he went to speak to the Blake family. He pleased them very much with his sensitivity to what they were going through. And you'd have to say the evidence so far is that the law and order campaign that Trump has been running since the convention has not shown much impact on the polls. He's still down 7 or 8 points. If you ask people on a whole range of measures, which candidate makes you feel safe, Biden wins on any way you ask that question, Biden wins. If you ask people, is Donald Trump making it worse, 55% say Donald Trump is making it worse. So the law and order message, at least so far, and as expressed through Kenosha, not working.
Jonathan, how did you see this?
Well, Judy, I look at it as at the two trips like this. One was a political, both were political trips, but one was political, the other was presidential. President Trump's trip was strictly political. To David's point, it was all about law and order. It was all about stoking fear, white grievance, white fear of black people, standing with law enforcement, which on its face is not wrong or bad or problematic, but in a city where a 17-year-old allegedly shot at three people, killed two of them, and those same police officers rolled right by him. The president has had nothing but good things to say about that person who was part of a militia, a right-wing militia. And so the president goes to Kenosha to, you know, buttress that. Joe Biden, on the other hand, I think did a presidential trip. He went to the Kenosha community to meet with the community, met with the Blake family, apparently talked with Jacob Blake. But the community meeting he did at a local church where he heard from all sorts of folks from the community was him sitting, listening, responding in kind. And a young woman, Portia Bennett, who decided not to read the list of demands from her organization, but instead decided to talk from the heart and talk to Vice President Biden about how, quote, heavily angry she and her community are about not being treated fairly. And the way Joe Biden responded to that, I think, was sort of a balm over the entire situation. Because in situations that happen, as have happened in Kenosha, people look to the president for calm, for leadership. They got that from Joe Biden, but Joe Biden isn't the president.
Well, we both candidates during this past week have released TV ads that address racial unrest, address protests around the police. Here's just a short clip from each one.
Rioting is not protesting. Looting is not protesting. It's lawlessness, plain and simple. And those who do it should be prosecuted. Fires are burning and we have a president who fans the flames. He can't stop the violence because for years he's fomented it.
Lawless criminals terrorize Kenosha. Joe Biden takes a knee. Biden and the radical left's weak response has led to chaos and violence. And their calls for defunding police would make it worse.
David, what do these messages tell you?
Well, Biden did something his party failed to do during the convention, which was to acknowledge that there is disorder in the country. Crime really is rising. And there has been rioting and looting. It's not the mainstream of the protests, but it's been an element of the protests. Maybe about 8% of the protests have turned violent. That's still a lot. And it's still on people's minds. And so with that speech and then the ad they've cut out of it, he's acknowledging that. And he's making a clear statement, which we talked about last week, of setting a boundary that rioting and looting are not protesting, and that he's going to crack down on that. And that was acknowledging a real flaw in the Democratic approach at the convention, where they just didn't see that reality. And so I think he helped himself. I mean, his team, the downside of his team is they're really experienced. So they've been part of the Democratic Party for a long time. The upside of his team is they're really experienced, and they know how to run a campaign. I think they've run a very effective campaign straight through, and it showed again this week.
Jonathan, does that ad help Joe Biden?
I think that ad helps Joe Biden because he makes a clear line, which is obvious to folks on the ground, that there is a distinct difference between the peaceful protesters who are out there wanting their voices heard about what happened to Jacob Blake being shot in the back 7 times by police officers. That young woman I just mentioned, Portia Bennett, she even in her remarks said she was there speaking not for the not for the rioters and the looters. No, she is there speaking on behalf of the protesters who want equity. And I do think I agree with David, it is important and good that Vice President Biden put that ad out there and made it clear that he draws a line and a distinction. And I don't think he's reacting to President Trump as much as he's reflecting the reality on the ground and the reality as the protesters see it. They're not part of the rioters or the looters either.
Two other quick things I want to ask you both about. David, has to do with several announcements from the administration in recent days about rapid testing for COVID. The president talking about we're going to have a vaccine this fall, maybe in October. Is all this likely to be effective in changing the minds of voters who are skeptical about his leadership or just don't know what to think?
Well, willing a vaccine into existence like a week before the election, probably not going to work. It's not the way science works. But I have to give the administration some credit on the rapid testing. And the Abbott labs apparently come with a breakthrough that gives you a chance to do testing fast. And the administration has poured a lot of money toward that to get 150 million of these tests. And for all the flaws of the administration's COVID response, they've done a decent job of pouring money both toward a vaccine and toward testing. And so I give them some credit on that. From what I understand of this test, it's not the ultimate solution for testing. You want to be able to test at home and et cetera. But if we could do rapid testing, you could test as people go into schools and conferences and buildings. That could be effective, that's a step back toward normalcy. And I have to give them some credit where credit's due. They've put a lot of money into this.
Clearly, everybody wants a vaccine as soon as possible. Jonathan, and what about the political effects of this?
Well, what's unfortunate about what the administration is doing, I mean, great on the rapid testing, A vaccine coming before the election, not so sure about that. But it seems that all of these moves are being made not because of compassion for the sick and for the infected and for those who died, but as a political maneuver to shore up a political problem that the president has. He has not been handling the response to the coronavirus pandemic well at all. And I think what the American people have been looking for is, where is the national plan? What are you doing to safeguard our health, but by extension, safeguard our livelihoods? Because the pandemic has hit us in our health, but it's also hitting us in the pocketbook and our livelihoods.
Finally, to both of you, this article that raised a lot of eyebrows that has just come out in The Atlantic overnight. David, Jeffrey Goldberg reporting from anonymous sources, but in his words, credible sources, that the president used words like suckers and losers over the course of his presidency, talking about people who served in the military, people who died in war. The White House completely denies this. Do you see something like this having an effect?
Yeah, I mean, Jeffrey Goldberg has had a whole series of scoops coming out of the Pentagon and the Defense Department and administrations going back for decades now, so he's a high credibility journalist. The story has now been confirmed by several other news organizations, including Fox News. And so we can fully expect that he dishonored the war dead by calling them losers and suckers. And it's not so far out of reach of what he said in public about John McCain and others. So I find it completely credible. And that the idea that a guy who is offended by Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, he says that dishonors the country, but calling the war dead losers, that's an absurdity. And so people are rightly offended. I mean, we get offended by this guy on an hourly basis, but this is an offense that goes to the core of conservative value system, the military value system. And what's been shocking to me this year is already, even before this happened, according to surveys of active military personnel, they were already for Biden, which is extremely rare for the active military to be for Democrats. And so he was already in trouble with this group, and it's got to trouble everybody who's in and out of uniform.
Jonathan, what are you thinking about this?
I didn't think I could be shocked anymore, particularly since Charlottesville, about what the president says or thinks about things or individuals. I was horrified by what I read attributed to the president of the United States, where Jeffrey Goldberg got based on four sources. And the fact that, to David's point, that it has been corroborated by other news organizations, including my own, the Washington Post, tells you something. And it is shameful. But I think what is even more shameful is the silence from Republican leaders around the nation and from Capitol Hill.
Tough subject. Tough everything right now. It's hard to think of something uplifting. But we appreciate both of you. Thank you for being here. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, thank you. Stay with us. We will reflect on some of the lives lost due to COVID-19. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. The coronavirus pandemic has dealt a huge blow to the music industry. Concerts, as we knew them, were one of the first things to be canceled and will be among the last to start. We take a second look at Jeffrey Brown's report. This encore presentation is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
It's been a long time. I shouldn't have left you.
Derek Jones, better known by his stage name D-Nice, calls it Club Quarantine.
Welcome back to Club Quarantine.
A creative response born of necessity in March when COVID-19 brought live music performances to a stop.
I'm used to interacting with people and feeling energy from people. I mean, you can drop a hot record and you can watch the crowd go crazy. Well, how do you do that online?
A prominent hip-hop producer, rapper, and DJ who's used to playing live in clubs around the world, he now performed from home on Instagram Live, spinning records for hours, mixing in conversations with fellow artists.
I cannot believe this.
What's up?
Watching the digital crowd swell from a few hundred to more than 100,000 around the world.
Oh my gosh, Michelle Obama's in here. Michelle Obama's in here.
That included celebrities as eager as everyone else for a dance party.
What does it do for you in terms of reaching an audience? Because it's really a totally different way of interacting with an audience, right?
Oh, totally. Initially, it was strange. I just started reading the comments. I would just pay attention to what they were saying and the energy that they were feeling. And also, there's a feature on Instagram where if someone's appreciating what you're doing or saying or enjoying that conversation, they will constantly hit the heart button. I just kept seeing hearts flying. Every time I would play a song, hearts were just flying. And that was the energy that I was feeling. Honestly, it is one of the most exciting feelings that I've had recently in terms of DJing.
The pandemic has devastated the world of the arts with concert halls, clubs, and theaters shut down and forced a different kind of survival mode creativity. More recently, live has returned in limited ways, including at some drive-in shows, the audience in or near their cars, distanced from one another. The rock band Spafford was one of the first to try a drive-in concert in the U.S. in Mesa, Arizona in May. COVID-19 had cut short the band's nationwide tour in March. I'm not in In the months following, they held Zoom calls, practiced in their homes, and came up with plans for the drive-in show. Brian Moss is Spafford's guitarist.
You were probably worried about when you would get up there at all, right? So there you were, and what happened?
It felt totally new. I was playing a G chord, and I was like, man, this is just the best-sounding G chord I could ever play. Like, every note had a different feeling. It felt like I was relearning, you know, how to play in a band like all over again. And it was totally vulnerable. And that's kind of where I want to be when I'm on the stage, because that's where the risks happen and that's where the fun starts.
A magical moment and maybe more to come. The global entertainment company Live Nation put on a 3-city drive-in tour with big names like Brad Paisley and Nelly. But for bands like Spafford, is this a viable solution going forward?
No, this is not a way to keep the band financially stable. It won't break us, but the joy of playing music and the joy of bringing music to our fans is the most important part in something like this.
But artists aren't the only ones impacted by the lost revenue.
It feels like there's a death sentence hanging over our industry.
Dana Frank is owner of First Avenue in Minneapolis, a legendary 50-year-old club where, among much else, Prince performed and filmed Purple Rain. Now it sits empty. Its 500 employees dwindled to 20.
It doesn't surprise me that people are out there experimenting and trying to provide this, you know, service and value for their community, but it's not a revenue stream. You know, it's not a solve for the industry. It's like trying to fill a swimming pool with a drop of water. You know, it's fun and like it provides some like distractions and some meaningful experiences for people, but it doesn't make a business survive.
Frank is president of the National Independent Venue Association, which formed in April and hired a lobbying firm to press Congress for a lifeline. The group now has nearly 2,000 member venues, including many that have made a mark in music history. She says clubs like hers have enormous economic impacts on their communities. She cites a study showing every dollar spent on a ticket generates $12 of economic activity for local businesses like restaurants, hotels, and cabs. But there's even more at stake than dollars.
What's lost if a club like yours or others go under?
I can't even, it's so hard to think about. You lose an entire subsect of culture. You lose experiences that people maybe didn't even know they could have. It's, you know, our venues, our spaces are where people go to celebrate the best nights of their lives. they meet their spouses there. They have these like intense emotional and cultural experiences that can't be held anyplace else.
Where will the music go from here? Dee Nice is still spinning, but also wondering what's next. This isn't a substitute for live performance, is it? Do you continue on with the Club Quarantine, or what happens?
So I don't think that this is a substitute at all, because there's nothing like being in front of a live audience. You know, that energy is unmatched. But I can't imagine me discontinuing any of these performances in the future, because I happen to like this too. I think this is a great addition. I know that the music is ultimately saving lives. You know, I don't want to think of myself as an essential worker, but I know that there are people out here that truly needed this experience.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
As yet another devastating week comes to an end, we want to take the time to honor individuals who've fallen victim to this deadly virus. Lillian Tourette was a fighter, her daughter said. Born in Guatemala, Lillian came to the United States at 22 years old. Life wasn't easy. She woke up at 3 in the morning to start working, often taking on two or more jobs to support her two children. For 20 years, she worked in a Los Angeles County middle school cafeteria. Beloved by the teachers and students for her cheerfulness, Lillian was 54 years old. 62-year-old James Mahoney was described by his sister as a supportive father of three and a caring doctor. He went by Charlie, and when his dream to play professional baseball didn't pan out, he turned to medicine. Charlie spent more than three decades serving his students and patients in Brooklyn, most recently as a critical care specialist for two hospitals. His sister said Charlie was quiet growing up, but was outgoing with his patients. Alex Bernard was known as Pastor Alex, an outreach pastor in Downey, California, who preached, fed, and helped others, including Mexican inmates. A program that saved Alex from drug abuse at a young age introduced him to the ministry he served for 30 years. With his wife, he helped others rebuild their lives. The 57-year-old was silly and compassionate, his daughter said. He was a father to eight, including four adopted children. Duane Trez Lovett was a big guy with a bigger heart, his mother said. Following in her footsteps, Duane Trez became a barber. He was known for the sound advice and mentoring he gave to anyone in his chair. With his 5-year-old daughter, he strived to be the father he never had. They love spending time with their dogs and going to the local park in Hazelwood, Missouri. In February, he wed the love of his life in a ceremony surrounded by family. Duane Trez was 29 years old. Jeff Kurtzman was full of aloha, or love, his friend said, known for his warm heart and giving nature. The Los Angeles native moved to Honolulu when he turned 18. For more than three decades, Jeff worked as a flight attendant for Hawaiian Airlines. Spiritual, an adventurer, and lover of the outdoors, Jeff was also an avid photographer. Wherever he went, he had his camera with him. Jeff was 60 years old. And we thank all the family members who contributed to these stories. Our hearts go out to you and all those who've lost loved ones in this pandemic. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a good Labor Day weekend. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.